Welcome to the Free to Choose Media Podcast. Today's podcast is titled Global Power in the Age of AI, featuring Dr. Paul Shari, Executive Vice President and Director of Studies at the Center for New American Security and author of Four Battlegrounds, Power in the Age of Artificial Intelligence, about the U.S.-China race for AI dominance. This episode from 2023 explores whether democracies can counter China's long-term strategic thinking and the growing export of techno-authoritarian surveillance systems to over 80 countries worldwide. Join host Jim Falk, President Emeritus of the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth, and Dr. Shari as they discuss technological advancements and its effects on the geopolitical landscape. We hope you enjoy today's episode, and don't forget to subscribe to the Free to Choose Media Podcast.
Welcome, and thanks so much for joining us today. I'm Jim Falk. The geopolitical landscape is undergoing rapid change, brought about what, not too long ago, might have been considered inconceivable technological advancements. And yes, I am thinking of AI, artificial intelligence, an area where China is determined to stake out its position as the global leader by the end of this decade. And if China does surpass the United States, what are the implications on democracy and our economy? To help us sort through these important questions, we're joined by Dr. Paul Shari. He's the Executive Vice President and Director of Studies at the Center for a New American Security. He's also the author of Four Battlegrounds, Power in the Age of Artificial Intelligence. Paul, thanks so much for joining us today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So I have here your book, and I thought one of the things that was so helpful is every day it seems like in the paper we're reading China's ahead, the United States is falling behind, or vice versa. And you really identified four elements, ingredients, that helped me frame this race. And I'd love for you to take a minute or two and really just to highlight what those are.
Well, thank you. And I'm glad you enjoyed the book. And it really came out of this investigation that I was doing, working in the national security space, to try to answer this question that you're raising of who's ahead, the U.S. or China, but ahead in what? How do we measure progress in artificial intelligence? And we saw during the Industrial Revolution, for example, that nations rose and fell on the global stage based on how rapidly they industrialized, but it also changed the key metrics of power. Coal and steel production became key inputs of national power. Oil became a geostrategic resource that countries were willing to fight wars over. So what is that in an age of AI? And the conclusion that I came to when researching the book is that there are four key battlegrounds of competition in artificial intelligence: data, computing hardware or computer chips, human talent, and institutions. The human organizations that are needed to take these raw inputs of data, computing hardware, and talent and turn them into useful AI applications. And whoever leads in these four areas will have the opportunity to lead an AI-driven future.
So the obvious follow-up question is, where are we leading and where is China leading? And is that a static race?
Well, it's certainly not static in the sense that both the U.S. and China are working hard to improve their competitive advantage across all of these four areas. Now, China has said that their intention is to be the global leader in AI by 2030. And I take them pretty seriously at that goal. China is a global AI powerhouse. But I do believe the United States has core advantages, particularly in hardware, in computer chips, and in human talent, with the United States as the destination of choice for AI scientists from around the world. That gives the United States a competitive edge if the U.S. can double down on these advantages and hardware and talent to stay ahead of China.
Let me ask you about data, however, because we often hear, because of China's much larger population than the United States, that they are able to supply more information into the algorithms that drive generative AI.
Right. So, where does a competitive advantage in data come from? Data is really essential for machine learning because machine learning systems, which are really driving the AI revolution at the moment, they're trained on data. So having access to large, diverse data sources is really essential for leadership in AI. China has a bigger population than the United States, And China has a very different political economy internally, and the Chinese government is engaged in massive surveillance against its citizens, and it's hoovering up huge volumes of data. So China has, for example, half of the world's 1 billion surveillance cameras. And they're increasingly using AI tools like facial recognition or gait recognition to track and monitor their citizens. And all of that is data that can go back in to feed Chinese algorithms. So those are areas that might be a competitive edge for China. But I ultimately conclude in the book that China's alleged advantage in data is overstated, in part because it turns out that national population matters far less than the user base of tech companies. And U.S. tech companies have global reach. So Facebook and YouTube have over 2 billion users globally each. So U.S. tech companies are not confined to the U.S. population. Whereas Chinese tech companies, other than TikTok, have actually struggled to gain a foothold outside of China. And the surveillance powers that the Chinese Communist Party has internally don't always apply to Chinese companies. And so on data, the U.S. and China are in many ways on a pretty level playing field.
But, you know, I hear what you're saying, but I've also, from your book and in other sources, that China has been incredibly effective in exporting a lot of its technology, primarily, for example, to the Global South.
That's right. And so one of the things that's deeply troubling is we're seeing the development inside China of this techno-authoritarian model of surveillance, monitoring its citizens, building facial recognition cameras in subways and bus stations and train stations, and then linking that to police cloud databases that can track and monitor people's movements, and even within China, a social credit system that scores people based on their behavior, whether or not they're, for example, sorting their recycling, and then putting in place a system of carrots and sticks to manipulate the behavior of Chinese citizens. And that's disturbing enough inside China, but we're seeing increasingly export of Chinese-style, not just technology for surveillance, but also their laws and norms behind this kind of new dystopian surveillance state that China is building. In Africa, Southeast Asia, and South America, there are over 80 countries in the world that have adopted Chinese police and surveillance technology. And it's a very troubling trend.
And isn't it true that that is to a lot of our allies? Like, am I right that the UAE, for instance?
That's right, including countries that are partners of the United States, countries like the UAE, even countries in Europe. And so it's really essential that democracies get together to push back against this creeping trend of techno-authoritarianism. Not just the technology itself, surveillance cameras can be used for good or bad, and there are good uses as well. But also, what are the rules in place for society about how we're going to use this technology?
So when you say countries in Europe, give me a few. I assume Hungary, but what
other
countries?
We've seen, for example, like Germany and others adopting surveillance technology. And you know, some of them, again, can be useful uses. London is one of those heavily surveilled cities in the world, has extensive cameras in public areas. But what's really essential is that the way the technology is used in ways where it has accountability for the government and transparency so that there's clarity to citizens about what the government authorities are. And there's restrictions, of course, on what the government can do with that technology.
I'm a great fan, and I suspect a lot of our viewers are as well, of BritBox. And it seems like every British crime detective story, they always say, have we checked the CCTV? And there's so many cameras there. You know, you talked about talent. And the United States, as we know, has tremendous universities and advancements and focus on AI, particularly here we are in Dallas, Texas, with Texas Instruments. But I'm wondering what your views are about some of the constraints that our immigration system has put on talent. And are we seeing more of these highly qualified people going to the UK or Australia or even Canada?
Well, it is a real challenge. The United States is the destination of choice for AI scientists from around the world, including from China. Now, China produces more top AI scientists than any other country in the world, but they don't stay in China. They leave and they come to the United States, and then they stay here after graduation. In fact, over 90% of Chinese undergrads who do their PhD in computer science in the United States stay in the U.S. after graduation. It's a huge advantage for the United States. And there are legitimate concerns about intellectual property theft and academic espionage that we need to police. But we also want to make sure that we're making it easier for top scientists to come to the United States from around the world. And right now, there's a lot of barriers in our immigration system, long wait times for visas, not just for Chinese scientists, but those from India and elsewhere that are really constraining American innovation. It's making it harder for us to tap into this global talent.
You know, just this morning, I picked up a paper from the American Enterprise Institute, and it said 10 ways the United States is falling behind China in national security. And I'm not going to go through all of them, but I'd like to read number 10. Artificial intelligence. Beijing is mounting a coordinated and rapid effort to advance AI applications in security and military domains, and Washington cannot rely on its existing private sector-driven dominance for long. And in your book, you really did devote considerable chapters to the disconnect, if you wish, between the private sector in the United States and government, particularly the defense industry. And I wonder if you might talk about that. And are we seeing stronger bridges being built between Silicon Valley and the Pentagon?
Well, one of the striking things in this new technology competition is that the technology is being driven by the private sector, as you said. So unlike, for example, like the nuclear arms race during the Cold War, where governments were driving that, or the space race, where it was government spending driving spending on space technology, now it's coming out of the private sector. And so the government's actually having to try to import AI technology from private companies. And there have been areas where there's been a bit of a culture clash sometimes on ethics, with tech company employees saying they don't want to work with the US military, for example, on AI, but also a lot of times just on business model approaches, where government red tape and bureaucracy gets in the way of the government being able to reach out to startups and really tapping into that thriving pool of innovation in Silicon Valley and other parts of the country that we need to do if we're going to capitalize on some of these technologies.
Now, what type of connection is there between the Pentagon and Silicon Valley? In the sense, does the Pentagon have an office in California now? And how do they handle some of the security issues?
Well, we're seeing the Pentagon do more to try to reach out to Silicon Valley and tech startups in other parts of the country as well. A few years ago, the Defense Department established the Defense Innovation Unit, an outpost out in Silicon Valley. Mm-hmm. It's been a bit of a challenge, and predominantly the problem has been on the government side. That the government has struggled, has a hard time moving quickly, and they've struggled to scale innovation. So there have been some success stories of Defense Innovation Unit or other parts of the U.S. military bringing in small startups, using them for some kind of project on drones or using AI for predictive maintenance for aircraft engines, for example. But then when the Defense Department tries to scale that up across what is in the U.S. military an $800 billion enterprise, so it's a big organization, that's when often they run into roadblocks. There could be bureaucratic red tape that gets in the way, and that's slowing down the government's ability to move fast.
Do you think we have a coherent strategy now on AI?
No, definitely not. We have a lot of documents. We have a lot of papers. The government's been pretty forward-leaning in publishing papers out of the White House and the Defense Department and other parts of government. But when you look at execution, it's poor. And we are at a real risk of falling behind China. When he was the Secretary of Defense, Secretary Mark Esper testified before Congress that AI was his number one priority. But when you look at Defense Department spending, it's not even close. It's about 1% of the U.S. military's budget. That's nowhere close to a top priority.
And so we're going to have to move faster.
Well, a big part of the problem is that when the military tries to scale up to large projects, we see that the system in place, the bureaucracy, has designed ways to slow everything down. So one clear example is the U.S. military a couple years ago tried to invest in a cloud computing contract, $10 billion for cloud computing for the Defense Department. This is not an absolute cutting-edge technology. It's several years old now. Lots of companies have enterprise cloud computing. But when they put $10 billion on the table, that's a lot of money, and companies start playing for keeps. And so we began to see companies that didn't win the contract filing protests, filing lawsuits. All of this gummed up the works, slowed down the government for 2.5 years. Before they finally surrendered, they killed the project and started afresh with a new one so the companies could all get a slice of the pie. And that's a real problem, and it's really slowing down innovation.
You know, just in the month of August, the Biden administration came out with new executive orders, and I guess it's now in that comment period where they are putting in, I think, pretty serious, significant restrictions on U.S. companies about the investments that they can make in AI and quantum computing and chips. And they say that it's primarily addressed towards military and security issues. But I wonder how concerned you are that, in a sense, this is becoming a situation where we do something, China's going to retaliate. They've already said that they may put some restrictions on what rare earth minerals can be exported to the United States. So are we on a path towards, you know, very serious continued deterioration between the relations with China and the United States?
Well, certainly the broader political relationship between the United States and China is very fraught. And there are just fundamental ways in which the U.S. and China have very different political goals about the future of the order in the Indo-Pacific region. But on technology, I think we're actually seeing a healthy rebalancing of the relationship, where for the last 20 years, the U.S. has really had unconditional engagement with China on technology issues. That's never been the case on the Chinese side. They've always conditioned engagement. If you go to China and you pull out your phone, you can't access Google or Google Maps or Facebook. They're all banned inside China because China's been building a censored version of the internet inside China. They're very controlling in terms of foreign technology coming in, but they want to find ways to steal that technology and benefit from it. And so now we're seeing, I think, just a correction from the United States really started under the Trump administration and being continued in the Biden administration, to find ways to condition some of these relationships, not to cut off all trade between the U.S. and China, it's actually at an all-time high, but to look at key technology areas and say, look, we need to make sure that we're not aiding and abetting the rise of a strategic competitor.
That makes sense what you're saying, but we've seen with the sanctions directed towards Russia that they're incredible leaks. And isn't that a real risk, perhaps, you know, Vietnam, South Korea? I mean, how do we really ensure that we are restricting China's access to the technology?
Well, I think it's going to be a moving target. And this is not the last restriction that we're going to see, this new executive order. And in fact, you know, as you mentioned, the government has said that they have some proposed rules and they're soliciting comment from industry. And I think we're going to see more continued refinement. But over the last couple of years, the U.S. government's been increasingly cracking down on U.S.-China tech ties, trying to ensure that U.S. technology is not enabling the Chinese military or human rights abuses inside China. And that's absolutely essential. And we need to make sure that the U.S. is keeping its technological edge.
Paul, I want to pivot just for a moment because the other book you wrote is Army of None. And you wrote in 2017 that an article that was published in Time magazine, and the title was Why We Must Not Build Automated Weapons of War. And that does seem to be a concern, and we're drifting closer and closer to that. Would that be the title of your article today?
Oh, that's a good question. I think we're getting much, much closer now to seeing autonomous weapons deployed on the battlefield, quite possibly in the near term in Ukraine, that can go out, find targets, and attack them all on their own. And we need to set limits among nations about what militaries are going to do with AI and autonomy. And in the absence of that, I do think there are some real risks going forward. We don't want to be Luddites, and there are good ways to use AI technology to make weapons more precise and more humane. But I think it is vitally important that humans remain in control of war. But absolutely, the technology is moving forward very fast and has developed quite a great deal in just the last few years.
And I think this question can be addressed to AI as well as automated autonomous weapons of war. What role is there that the United Nations or other multilateral organizations might play, as we saw with the Non-Proliferation Treaty addressing nuclear weapons?
Well, I think it's a great example where for nuclear weapons, we've been able to build among countries a set of global institutions, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, the International Atomic Energy Agency, that have been able to limit the spread of nuclear weapons over time. Not completely stop it, but slow its spread while permitting the spread of nuclear technology for civilian uses, for peaceful nuclear energy. And we want to do the same for AI. A good way it looks like to do this is to focus on hardware, on the chips that are used to train some of these very powerful AI systems, to make sure that we're allowing peaceful, beneficial uses of AI, but controlling possible uses that could be dangerous using AI for weapons or carrying out terrorist attacks, for example.
Well, there's such a cost to building the hardware that is needed, and I wonder if you might help us all understand what the cost is today, and do you expect that cost to go down? You know, we often talk about Moore's Law, and it seems to me that what I've been reading and hearing is that Moore's Law, you can just forget that when you're talking about AI.
Well, there are two kind of parallel trends that are going underway, which kind of push in opposite directions here. So one is the amount of computing power that's being used to power the most capable AI systems has been growing at a rapid exponential rate. It increased 10 billion-fold from 2010 to 2022. So remarkable rate of growth, much faster than Moore's Law. Now, some of that comes from better chips, but some of it actually comes from companies just spending more. Current state-of-the-art models cost on the order of tens of millions of dollars to train just the final version of the model. And we're probably moving in the next couple of years to $100 million models and likely even billion-dollar models. Huge expenditures. That's going to lock out a lot of other companies. It's already locking out academics from competing to build these very capable systems. But there are other trends, and some of them are improved hardware. They're going to make it possible to train powerful systems more cost effectively. And some of them are on the algorithms that also mean they just need less computing power to train AI models. So what we're likely to see, and this is what we've seen in the last couple of years, is that the most advanced systems become more expensive, limited to a small number of companies that can build them, but then they rapidly proliferate. And in just a few years, they become pretty widely available to anyone.
And take a moment just to remind us what Moore's Law is.
So Moore's Law has been a phenomenon that was first observed by Gordon Moore. And we've seen over the last several decades improving chip performance, doubling roughly every 24 months. Right now, the types of chips that are used for AI systems, graphics processing units, are doubling about every 2.5 years. So slowing down a little bit from 2 years to 2.5 years. Some people would tell you Moore's Law is dead because it's not quite at the same pace as before. But we are continuing to see advancements in chips. But again, there are also advancements in these algorithms. And then companies are spending a heck of a lot of money.
So when you look at artificial intelligence and the cost, you know, one of the things about nuclear weapons is by and large, well, not by and large, I mean, it's been controlled and it's been major powers. And what you're saying is that with artificial intelligence, as the cost goes down, for lack of a better term, bad actors are going to be able to use that. So how do we protect ourselves, one, as a nation, and two, as individuals, from that threat?
Well, it's a real concern. One of the challenges that we've seen in just the last year has been a real explosion in more general purpose AI systems. So older AI systems like AlphaGo, the AI program that achieved superhuman performance in Go, the Chinese strategy game, that could just play Go. It couldn't play chess or write a poem or do computer programming. And the newer systems like ChatGPT, they can do all of those things and many more, which means they're inherently dual use. They can be used to write computer code, and they can also be used for cyber attacks. They can be used to conduct scientific experiments, and researchers have demonstrated this. They can also be used to generate chemical weapons or biological weapons. And these are just theoretical problems. AI scientists have demonstrated these capabilities with some of the most advanced AI systems. So we've got to find ways to control the spread of these models, including things like, for the most powerful systems, probably controlling them. So you can't just put it on the internet for anyone to get access to it. But also, over time, we're going to have to harden society against some of the dangers of, say, more powerful AI-enabled cyber attacks.
And would you agree that so far, U.S. companies and the developers of ChatGPT 1234 have been largely responsible?
No, I don't think they've been super responsible at all.
Okay.
I know. I think we've seen a bunch of problems from the industry. And there's going to be two big ones. One is that some companies are just releasing their models open to the public. Meta recently released their large language model, Llama 2. And Meta did a lot to try to fine-tune this model to make it safe. But once it's publicly available, it's effectively giving away the source code. Anybody else can find ways to modify it and misuse it. I think that's a real problem. But the other thing is, even when companies have been restrained in releasing their models, like Google and OpenAI, what we have seen is that companies have often raced to deploy things before they're ready. And we saw that between Google and OpenAI and Microsoft earlier this year, where they're racing to get out in front of each other, and they're putting things out there to engage with the world that oftentimes are not reliable, they make stuff up, they have a lot of problems, and I would like to see the companies be more responsible.
Give me in 30 seconds, if you would, Paul, how do you evaluate the Biden administration's approach towards China, particularly in the AI realm sphere?
I think the administration has done a good job. I think they've continued work that started in the Trump administration to try to really reorient the U.S. relationship with China, crack down on some of these more problematic aspects of U.S.-China tech cooperation without trying to throw it out entirely. And that's the right approach. There's going to be some fine-tuning going forward, but that kind of carefully calibrated approach that the administration is striving for is the right one.
Paul, I really appreciate the time you spent with us today. Covered a lot of information. Thank you. Today's conversation reminds us that our short-term thinking often puts us at a competitive disadvantage. And this is especially true with China, where its leaders have the luxury of thinking ahead, not just in years, but decades. International organizations such as the United Nations, in addressing potential regulations, must realize that the United States, along with its liberal democratic allies, might have very different goals than, say, China, Russia, and the growing number of authoritarian states who see AI as a means to gain and, yes, maintain power. Thanks so much for spending part of your day with us, where we always talk about things that matter with people who care.
Want more episodes like this? Don't forget to subscribe and get updates each week for the Free to Choose Media podcast.